Showcase. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial. This is the final stream of this, the first night of Millennial 8. And I am here with Imperium Press, or rather, Mike from Imperium Press. You describe Imperium Press as an illiberal publishing house. Would you like to briefly introduce it to people, just in case anyone isn't familiar with it, Mike? And welcome to Millennial.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Sure. Yeah. So Imperium Press was started in, I think it officially formed in 2018, but we put out our first book in 2019, late 2019. And basically we call ourselves the classics department of the right. And basically the aim with Imperium Press, at least initially, was to reclaim the Western canon for ourselves. Because if you read mainstream, you know, editions of things like the Iliad or Beowulf and Dante and things like that, very often it's going to be framed in terms that, number one, are kind of antithetical to right-wing thought, but even more importantly, are not really in the spirit of the text themselves. So a very quick example would be the Fagles translation of Homer's Iliad. It's introduced by a very good scholar by the name of Bernard Knox, but he frames it in terms of, you know, Iliad is something that's it transcends cultures. It's universal. It's, you know, it speaks to all men in all times and all places. But I think that that's actually not right. It it really more speaks to us as Europeans. It needs to be understood in the context of its, like, as a warrior culture, an aristocratic warrior culture. So this is just a small example of how we would reframe a text, and the Iliad was the first book we put out. So that was kind of what Imperium Press started out as. But very quickly, we started putting out contemporary works by authors in the dissident right. And over the last couple of years, it's really just sort of grown exponentially to where we are now reaching quite a large audience, and in some cases, some people who are quite influential. So I'm very gratified about that. And it's been quite a journey. So that's basically what we're all about.
Okay. Just to pick up on what you just said there, because an idea occurred to me. This thing about like the Iliad, it's selling it as something that's universal and available, accessible to anyone. It reminded me, I once heard a civic nationalist talking about British culture. And he said, and you know, the best thing about British culture is that it's universal. Anyone can become British. The values, and you can even export it across the world, so anyone can adopt these values. And now, you can imagine that, you know, my blood pressure rose when I heard excited little rant there, because there are so many problems with it. I guess that the most important thing here is that, in his mind, the best, literally, he said the best thing about British culture is that it's accessible to anyone. I prefer the concept, just conceptually speaking, I prefer the idea of a culture that really isn't available, accessible to just anyone, that actually is very specific and esoteric, actually. Because otherwise what you've actually got is not so much a culture or even a set of values, but a set of rules, a set of propositions that anyone can like the sound of. And that's now them. They are now that thing. Well, that's absurd. You might as well have a contract that they can just sign the dotted line. And that's it. So there's nothing intrinsic about it. There's nothing organic about it.
Yeah, very much so.
It just sounds awful and soulless to me.
Well, I wonder if he would say that the best thing, you know, the, one of the best things about us, if you know, what's great is what we all share is one of the best things about us is that we breathe air or that we're warm blooded or something like that. Like for me,
yeah.
It seems like, you know, what's great about us as a people, as a set of peoples, as a folk is exactly what we don't share with other people. It's what makes us fundamentally is how we differ from other peoples. And I think that there's something there that sort of gets at the essence of what nationalism is all about. So if what makes British people great, for example, is that anyone can be British, this is just basically another way of saying that Britishness doesn't exist.
Exactly.
So, you know, I can imagine why it kind of got the hackles up on your back there. I very much sympathize
very with much. That. Very, and then also the other part of it, which really said that you can export it across the world, like, you know, how you can install democracy in Iraq and you can give LGBT yeah. stuff to the Afghanis and so. But you, in a similar way, 100, 150, 200 years earlier, you can give them British culture. But the thing is, you really can't. I mean, the only place, I guess you could say in the British Raj in India, and to some extent, there's still... they still have some version, some ghosts of that now. In some sense, they, you know, it's a well-known cliche that they're more British than the British because they have this sort of fossilized version of Britishness. But they're still not British. I mean, what they have is a sort of a program of for living or not even that, just a set of suggestions, some mannerisms and phrases and whatever, sort of artifacts of Britishness from a certain time, but there's it's still not Britishness, and they're still not British.
Culture is in some sense incommunicable. This is something I think it's a hard lesson for people to learn. It's something that we're kind of taught from a very early age to reject. Basically, you know, most people, you know, if you actually look at the studies of genomics and of, you know, intelligence or personality and things like that, people vastly underestimate the degree to which these things are heritable by blood, heritable through biology, essentially. And it's because we're taught from a very early age that basically radical environmentalism is right and that, race is skin deep and things like that. But the fact is that, you know, these things, you know, British culture has to be planted in a soil that is receptive to it, right? And I mean, you know, Indian people are in some sense, you know, sort of distant cousins to the British in being Indo-European. So there are some aspects of it that they can absolutely take on. But, you know, being so distant and so far separated for a long time, there's some things that they can't. It's one of those things that needs to be dispelled. And I think, you know, what was happening with the alt-right back in 2015, 2016 kind of era when it was really like HBD was kind of at its height and, you know, Steve Saylor was riding high and then this kind of thing, there was some real iconoclasm going on at that point that was very healthy. And, you know, it's kind of started to seep into the broader culture and it's kind of, you know, started to provoke, let's just say, elite institutions into making bad mistakes and overreacting and having this allergic reaction. So that's a good thing. But yeah, it is kind of ridiculous to, you know, look at people who think that somebody from North Dakota can be as Confucianist as somebody from, you know, Hunan province or vice versa, right? Like, you know, yes. Somebody who...
See, the way it resolves in the real world is that we end up with this concept of the rules-based society or the rules-based economy, which basically means we all agree to abide by certain rules. And that's it. That's the extent of culture. But that isn't the rightful extent of culture. Culture is something much deeper than that, than merely which rules do you abide by? Because, you know, an Afghani and a Chinese guy and an Indian and a Swede and all that can all agree to abide by the same rules, but they're not the same creature. It doesn't matter which rules they abide by. They're still not the same thing. So I don't, but this is a concept of the rules-based economy and so on that Tony Blair has come out with. And it's a fashionable idea because it pretends that, well, that's all there actually is to culture and to a society. It's just the rules, just the laws. And I think it's a really impoverished view of human affairs.
Yeah, it is impoverished because, I mean, what matters most to us, for the most part, is not what makes us the same, but it's what makes us different. And to kind of shoehorn people into this rules-based framework is very much to strip them of their, well, I don't want to say humanity because that sounds universal, but it's to strip them of their folkhood, of their identity. It is a very dehumanizing view of the world, which is, you know, crazy that, you know, people who consider themselves, you know, humanists or secular humanists, this is something that they push. But, you know, the fact is that there are very few kind of shared moral imperatives, shared cultural artifacts that we have across our species. And it's not clear. I mean, if this is kind of your ideology, which is that, you know, humanity is basically what makes us our sort of foundational identity is being human rather than being British or Canadian or Chinese or whatever. It's not clear why it should end at the level of the species and not continue on, right? Like, you know, and yes. I think this is part of where you get crazy stuff like Peter Singer, where he's not even happy with human rights. It's animal rights. And I mean, I'm not saying that you should abuse animals or anything like that, but it just, when you take it sort of, when you try and render this principle consistent, basically what you end up with is a kind of like runaway universalism that just doesn't actually tell you anything because we don't share enough for it to be able to give us shared moral imperatives and everything like that. So, and it obviously is corrosive to anything like nationalism. So like, you know, I think most people in their bones feel like they owe something to, you know, their family first, and then to their community, and then to the locality where they live, and then to the state, and then to their country, right? So you've got these concentric circles of care sort of radiating outwards. This is the normal, healthy, natural sort of, you know, human sociality. But for the liberal, it's kind of the opposite, actually. And I don't know if you saw it, it sort of made the rounds over the last few years. There's this this chart that basically shows you in a kind of like circular graph of like the horizons of care between liberals and conservatives. And for conservatives,
oh God, it's frightening. Yeah.
It is terrifying, right? Because basically the result is that conservatives sort of their core locus of moral care is something like the extended family. So this is where they sort of like put all their weight in terms of what they care about and everything. And then it gets weaker as it goes outwards into the community, into the nation, into humanity, into all life, into non-life and everything like that. For liberals, and this is like, I'm still like a year or two later, just dumbfounded at this. It like the sort of locus of moral care, like the heaviest weighted concentric circle for them is somewhere between all life and non-life. This is what they care. So they care about like rocks and trees more than they care about their own mother. Like this is what it's telling you. I it's hard to even accept. It's hard to even believe that. But apparently, you know, science tells me that. So yeah.
Yeah, I wonder to what extent it's true and to what extent it's an affectation. It's sort of outrageous. Because they cannot possibly care more about rocks and stones than they care about their mother. So there must be different levels of this where they'll profess concern for the foreign, the exotic, the distant. But then again, if you examine them by their behavior, you know, white liberals tend to stick around with other white liberals. So that would betray that they actually, you know, are as in-group preferential, so to speak, as any of us.
Well, there is a kind of tribalism to the SWPL, you know, the white liberal cat lady type. There is a tribalism, and they even say, they have a phrase, you know, I've found my tribe, right? Like, they get that. And them, I mean, they think that tribe just, like, automatically means, like, Native Americans or something. They don't realize that, like, Europeans were the most tribal people on Earth up until, you know, kind of recently in human history. But, you know, they found their tribe. This is, you know, for them, they get it, right? Except for their tribe is propositional. Their tribe is based on a proposition, right? So the tribe is not based on something that they were born with or something they can't change, which is, you know, this is a normal sort of, you know, this is the way that normal human sociality works. For them, their tribe is people who believe the same things as them, right? And of course, this is corrosive to anything like, you know, genuine nationalism or genuine tribalism, because your tribe is characterized as something like people who are born the same as you, or who have the same history as you, or something that they can't be changed, right? You can change your mind. Like, if you can be argued out of your tribe, it's a pretty weak tribe. Like, this is not a very good basis for human community. So there are reasons. And it's interesting because I've actually just dissected this pretty extensively on my new Substack that I've started this year, exactly why the propositional identity seems to have prevailed, at least for the moment. But yeah, that takes me a little bit further afield. It's just crazy how people sort of believe that that they share more with people who kind of have the same beliefs than with people whom they've grown up with, or that, like, they share a history and a past with, and everything like that. It's almost hard to imagine. It's hard to kind of get in their mindset and kind of understand where they're coming from.
Indeed. In fact, I think they take it further than that. They would find it sort of icky to... I mean, they would say that they find it icky. And at some level, I think it is genuine. The idea of... They find it sort of incestuous. Well, why would I want to be with people who are just like me? Because then, well, I know I'm not going to learn anything, am I? I know what they think. They know what I think. There's no mixing going on. I actually think this concept has become very deeply ingrained in the liberal psyche, such that, for example, when they see a group of white people, they instinctually think, ooh, that's unhealthy. It's white supremacy. It's incestuous. It's unadventurous. It's uninteresting, you know. And of course, this is also, as much as I think that's there are different types of belief, aren't there? So as much as that's a genuine belief, it's also an affectation.
Yeah, they seem kind of married to this, and even unconsciously so, to this idea of oikophobia, which is kind of a, you know, $5 word to describe just hating everything that's familiar. And like, this is kind of, they have a love of the outsider, and it's hilarious because obviously at this stage, progressive secular humanism has won, like, you know, unambiguously is stomping on all of us with its jackboot, and, you know, they still see themselves as the outsiders. They have this love.
Oh, God. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, they just love what's marginal and what is supposedly oppressed. It's this love of the outsider, this kind of revenge of the nerd, like, trait openness, a kind of desire to replace the center with the margin. And this is what I mean by oikophobia. And I mean, to some extent, like, if we're going to give the devil his due, very often what you see in historical cultures, and we could name several of them, you actually do see this. You see something like a love of the outsider around the time of its cultural flowering, maybe a little bit after its cultural flowering, but right around the same time. But it also kind of leads to the thing's death, right? Like, so you could kind of think of it as a flower, like an actual plant that, like, it grows and it's hardy and it's got this, like, you know, this rootstock that's just solid, right? And then it opens up and it blooms into this flower, and then the thing dies, right? Like, it's, you know, that not the biggest white pill in the world, but this is to say, you know, it will eventually come to an end and the cycle will begin again, which is, I think, a kind of white pill of its own. But you do see a kind of love of the outsider kind of towards the autumn and winter stages of human culture. Like, take, for example, in Rome. In Rome, kind of like maybe a century or two before the fall of the Republic, you actually saw a kind of like Hellenophilia, like a love of Greek culture, seep in. And Cato the Elder, who's like my Elvis, the guy is just awesome. He didn't like this very much. He saw this like new Greek culture that came in. He was like, it's kind of gay and effeminate, and I'm not really down with this. And he kind of railed very hard against it. And he wanted to cultivate the, you know, traditional Roman virtues of like ruralism and, you know, just hardy, like, you know, being agricultural lifestyle and everything like that. Of course, he kind of lost the battle eventually, but you know, these are the things, the sort of rootstock, this hardy foundation of the culture is kind of like what enables that blooming in the first place. So, I mean, you know, love of the outsider is a kind of double-edged sword, and it's something that just eventually comes and eventually does happen, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it now. It's sort of like bloomed in the 20th century, but it's not going to go on very long because this is a very enervating thing. This, like, culture can't really survive by being outward looking for very long. So, you know, I regard what we're doing in Imperium Press and what we're doing in the Dissident Right more broadly as kind of laying the foundations for what comes next, for a kind of revival or looking back inward towards our foundations and our roots, and taking that and building it into something genuinely new, not just backward looking, but something that takes the past and builds on that towards the future, because it's not going to go on all that much longer the way it is. So, you know, it's our job. We kind of just need to start building as the storm gathers, if you know what I mean.
Yes, yes. I mean, I have to say, I would love to be in a culture where people didn't lionize the outsider and the exotic. I would love to live in a society where people were happy just to be normal and only had an interest in their own culture, their own people. You know, I think that, and there are always going to be some a minority of people who are inquisitive and adventurous, and they want to explore the world, they want to learn about other cultures and all that, but it's a small minority. Most people I don't think are optimized for that. I don't think it's sincere when they voice an interest in these things, and I think it's bad for them to have that interest or to have that loyalty to the foreign, to the alien, to the exotic, because it detaches them from their own culture, their own people. And as I say, I don't really believe it's ever in normal people. I don't think it's ever sincere. I mean, you see this with hipsters, how they'll go on about, you know, diversity, multiculturalism, but they've got no actual interest in learning about other cultures, because learning about other cultures is actually a very onerous thing to do. It requires a lot of effort and time to do it seriously. What they actually mean is, I want the incredible range of restaurants. I want the choice, yeah, of different sensations, and the plaudits that come with being open-minded and, you know, declaring oneself open-minded. They want the social currency, but they don't actually give a shit about other cultures. I mean, it's not something that comes naturally to the vast majority of people, I think.
Yeah, they want the sort of superficial experience of it. They want to be able to dabble in, you know, Japanese Shinto, or in, you know, Native American ritual, you know, like rites and things like that. They want the sort of superficial experience. They kind of want the tourist experience of these things. But then when they're faced with the actual, like, you know, flesh and blood experience of them, they very often actually recoil from it. And they sort of find that the romance has gone out the window. Yes. You know, like it's very much, it's said that, you know, travel is fatal to prejudice, but in my experience, that's the opposite. Actually, I was very lucky as a child. Like, I lived overseas with my parents for a few years. Like, I lived in a Muslim country for a couple of years, and then my parents took me traveling. After that, took the family traveling, and we saw quite a few different parts of the world and everything. And for me, I just remember at the time, like, I had this almanac. You know, have you ever had one of those, like, world almanacs or whatever? Like, they've got all the statistics about the different countries and the different flags. And so I just carried this thing around with me like a talisman. I just, like, would, like, pour over it and just be like, what would it be like to live in Nepal? What would it be like to live in Japan? What it would be like in Venezuela or some of, like, all these different countries. And I got to actually visit some of them. And in my experience, travel is, rather than being fatal to prejudice, if you go off the beaten path just a little bit, like if you don't go into these, like, bug megalopolises, if you go anywhere else, that travel is actually very much reinforcing of prejudice. It really reinforces the fact that people are different, that, like, the one size actually does not fit all, that there are different peoples, and that this is a brute material fact of reality, and that different cultures are appropriate to different people. This is what I got out of traveling. I don't know. A lot of people, I think that they go to Berlin, and then they go to Paris, and they go to London, and then they call it a day, and they're like, yeah, I've seen the whole world, and everyone's just basically the same, and this and that, and this and that. It's not to say that, like, you know, London doesn't have its uniqueness, or Berlin or whatever, but I think if you went to, like, rural Bavaria, or if you went to the Scottish Highlands or something like that, rather than these metropolises, you get a very different picture. And for me, travel was definitely the opposite of fatal to prejudice. And I think that, you know, there are other people who have had a similar experience. You know, I was just listening to a podcast by Dan the Fergan with Emma Lucy Shaw. Are you familiar with her, or did you ever heard that podcast?
It's wonderful. I haven't heard the podcast, but both of them are going to be on Millennial. So
fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm actually very much looking forward to, like, so many of the guests. I'm really, really jacked about the schedule.
Oh, you
this
don't
year.
Need to say that.
No, I genuinely am. I always like it. I've been watching Millennial since, I think I went back and saw, I've been watching it since about 2018 or 2017 or something. But this year I'm really excited because there's a lot of new faces. There's a lot of people that I really am happy to see them get a platform. And anyway, to go back to what I was saying, you know, I won't take anything away from Emma's journey because she'll explain it herself. But basically, she has had the exact same experience as me, going to a foreign country and not finding at all what she thought she was going to find. And in fact, finding that it made her very much, you know, it sort of reinforced what we call the conservatism of the fringes. So I, for example, I'm a Canadian. I live in Australia now. And when I went to Australia, I was a hardcore libertarian, you know, very much a sort of, like, universalist view of the world. I disagreed with Stefan Molyneux on almost nothing. But having the experience of going to even a different country that's within the Commonwealth. So we basically share a similar culture, especially Canada and Australia, very similar. Still, it is made me into this rabid nationalist that, like, I very much miss my homeland. I love Australia, but, you know, it's made me understand at a very, very gut level what the importance is of being connected to the soil, to the place where I grew up. There is something very much to the idea of, you know, blood and soil. It's the two things go together very, very closely. So I think she's had a similar experience. I think some of the more thoughtful people who travel extensively also get the same experience. But, you know, if you kind of superficially just sort of like hop from one massive city to another, you're not going to experience any of that stuff. And I think that, unfortunately, some people spend a lot of money on these, you know, round the globe journeys and don't get a whole lot out of it.
Yeah, I think that there's a type of person, as I said, who enjoys it. But the thing is, nowadays, everyone assumes that, I mean, it's sold to everyone. And so I think a lot of people do it and tell themselves, oh, they had a good time. It was fascinating to see these far off places. But I am confident in my belief that most people are optimized. I mean, you know, Dunbar's number and all this kind of stuff. I think that people are optimized for living in a village, and especially normies. I mean, ironically, and this is going to sound like self-aggrandizement, but I think that people like you and me are probably actually, ironically, more inquisitive than the norm, and so would fare better. Would have more use for this stuff than most people. I think most of them, it's in the same way that they don't really have a use for freedom of speech because they don't really have that much to say. I mean, I know this sounds contemptuous. I don't mean it that way. I don't really enjoy thinking this. It just is what I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we genuinely believe, as we do, that the opposite of oikophobia, oikophilia, is a virtue, then this is not contempt at all. This is normal. This is praiseworthy. This is good. I mean, most people are just content to live where they live for most of their lives, or live where they were born, or not far from where they're born, and cheer for the home team and kind of drink from their own well. And I think that's an exactly. important thing.
And it's like there's a simplicity to the normie that I think is healthy and right and shouldn't be contaminated. It shouldn't be perverted with ideas of cosmopolitanism and whatever and traveling the world. I don't think it's what they need. I think it corrupts them.
Yeah. That's a symptom of a time. It's a time of decline. But, you know, after the trough comes the crest. So this is what we're looking to. This is what we're looking forward to is building producing the intellectual, the cultural, and even the institutional backbone or infrastructure of what's going to happen next. So, you know, it's interesting because the right, as we are characterized as being, is often thought of as very backwards looking and just wanting to kind of rehash old ideas and everything. But we're something different. The dissident right or the nationalist right or the radical right is something very different. We are looking towards the future. We are not, I mean, we look backwards as in we take what works in the past, you know, we take kind of the Lindy rule of like whatever's, you know, a thing is basically as likely to be around in proportion to how long it's been around already. And we sort of look at that. We say, okay, well, you know, hierarchy has been around for several million years. Patriarchy has been around for a long time. You know, ethnocentrism has been around for a long time. Maybe these things are the way they are, not by accident. Maybe there's a reason for it, right? And, you know, coupling that with this sort of, let's just call it a folkish epistemology of, you know, maybe people in the past knew things too. Like maybe the tradition is a kind of aggregate of like trillions of years of man hours of experience and that has something to teach us. If we take that, then I think that this gives us good reason to, you know, trust and accept, you know, what has already been established, and to take that and to build on top of it. Because if you think about, you know, I am a big fan of the Indo-Europeans, as most people who follow Imperium Press find out very quickly. I think that these people, you know, three and five people alive today speak an Indo-European language. I think that these people had some virtues that need to be rediscovered. And one of them is this kind of marriage between being the like ideal traditionalist, like the Indo-European was a ancestor worshiper that worshipped his line of fathers going back all the way to the high gods. But at the same time, he was also at the forefront of technical innovation, you know, domesticating the horse, developing metallurgy and bronze working and things like that. Like, this was not just a guy that was content to just do old things and never and just be stultified forever. There was a kind of, you know, dare I say it, cultured thug aspect to him. He kind of had the best of both worlds. And that I think that this is that what we're doing in the radical right, or as I think of it, as I call it, the Odinic right, is re-establishing that spirit, the spirit of looking both backwards and forwards in a kind of like Janus-like figure, this two-headed figure that looks to the past and the future. That's what we're doing. And I think that's why we are a genuine threat, the first genuine threat that has actually appeared in quite a long time against liberalism, is because they realize that there is potential here to really do something. So,
especially when their own worldview is, I'm not going to say crumbling, but it's definitely showing signs of wear and tear. Especially, actually, a good manifestation of that, I say good, what I mean is an instructive manifestation of that, would be the trans thing with kids, 20-somethings, now rebelling against what was suggested to them when they were adolescents. That's a perfect example of what I'm saying, where the paradigm is starting to become self-contradictory. It's starting to become delusional. It's starting to become blatantly untrue. And I think in a time like that, it is ripe for attack. And they must know that. I think that's why they spend so much time on censorship and pre-bunking and debunking what is said from the likes of us. Because I think they are very worried about their worldview being shown up. I mean, clearly, you know, to coin the phrase, if they had it all sewn up, then their propaganda would be unnecessary.
Yeah, and what's more, I don't even think they really believe their own myth, to be honest. I mean, maybe intellectually they do. They certainly spend a lot of time creating post hoc rationalizations of what they already want to do. But in their gut, I think there is a profound,
insecurity about
it. That's exactly, yeah. There's a profound insecurity at the heart of the progressive worldview, of the liberal worldview. That when a civilization or a culture or a, let's just say, a community's belief in its own myth dies, then the community is basically done for. And that what we're witnessing today is actually the death throes of liberalism. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, that's, you know, you're just coping or whatever. No, not at all. I think that elites and elite structures are going through some serious pain right now. Like, we could talk about any number of things that have happened in the last few months, even, not just years. Like the acquisition of Twitter by Elon Musk. I mean, whatever you think of him, the amnesty hasn't gone very far. Okay, sure, but it has sent the elite structures, the deep state, into a tailspin of like making stupid mistakes, and they're suffering a lot of pain. I for one, am thoroughly enjoying watching this. I mean, they're hysterical. These people are not acting like they're winning, that's for sure. And I've seen a few takes kind of floating around. I read a Substack article recently saying that the deep state is actually consolidating its power, and I think this is a ridiculous hot take. Like, they're not acting like an elite in control. They're acting like a woman who just had a spider drop down her shirt, right? They're just freaking the hell out and crying about Elon Musk buying Twitter. This is not the action of a regime that's in control, right? Like, having to rigorously ban even the most milquetoast dissent on Twitter and, you know, stating outright that Elon Musk not banning Donald Trump is a threat to our way of life is just like, it's not the action of a regime in control. I mean, sabotaging your own infrastructure, your allies' infrastructure, is not the action of a regime in control. These people are very, very worried about the future. And to be honest, they should be worried about the future, because the future is not going to belong to them very much longer. I mean, maybe in our lifetimes, but if you zoom out a little bit and look at sort of a longer, take a longer view, our grandchildren are going to be living in a world that's very different than ours, and very probably moving towards a world that's better for them than it is for us. I really genuinely think that. I think there's reason for hope and optimism there.
Oh, right. Well, good. I'm glad. I mean, I'm sure that we'll come back onto that. But you wanted to talk about Ukraine, and I think that flows quite naturally from what you were just saying. A year ago, 2 years ago, we talked about COVID and the World Economic Forum and the UN and all of that kind of thing. And there was a certain theory going around, which I found very interesting and quite compelling, that we're really talking about two different elites. One of them, the old sort of Zionist, warmongering, the Wall Street, Hollywood, that sort of elite. And now a newer one, or one that has sort of come of age, matured more recently, which is the technocrat, the less Jewish, but still heavily Jewish, but more sort of utopian and globalistic and progressive, but obsessed with technology and COVID, the vaccine, the pod, genetic engineering, weird artificial food, this kind of stuff. Would you like to say anything about that before I ask the actual question?
No, I mean, I go ahead. We could talk a little bit about Ukraine. I don't have like real.
Well, hold on a second. What I was going to say was, so in the midst of COVID, it seemed like there was a new elite, to put it very concisely, that was not the same as the old elite that we knew very well, that was, you know, always warmongering and so on. But now that elite seems to have come back in the shape of the war in Ukraine, pushing for that war. Would you agree with that framing that America, to use a euphemism, America pushed for the war in Ukraine to happen? Would you agree with that?
Well, they absolutely did. Yeah, very much. And I think that the elite that you're saying has come back is, in some sense, trying to recapture the glory days of the 2000s with Tony Blair and George Bush. This is just not the world that we live in anymore. America is not a hegemon the way it was back then. The thing is, America, like, war kind of works somewhat differently now than it has in the past, and even than it has 20 years ago. So there's, you know, the generations of warfare are fairly well known, from first generation warfare, which is basically, you know, tribal warfare, to second generation, which is basically like line and column and so on and so forth. And it goes all the way up to fourth and fifth generation warfare. Fourth generation warfare is something like guerrilla warfare. Think of like the Vietnam War. And fifth generation warfare is a step beyond that, where basically what each of these generations is trying to do is nullify the last one. So guerrilla warfare was trying to nullify third generation, which is basically like the Blitzkrieg, World War II, for example. So no longer is war fought with like these massive, like artillery offenses of like tanks, like moving across the, across like a huge like span of space. It's kind of fought in a way that through attrition and subterfuge and camouflage and blurring the like lines between friend and enemy. This is how a smaller country was able to repel a larger country. It's how Afghanistan was effectively able to weather the storm of the U.S. invasion. And now we have fifth generation warfare, which is basically trying to It's informational warfare. It's warfare. It's economic warfare. It's trying to cut off the ability for people to organize into these kind of like guerrilla units and everything. And I mean, we shouldn't overplay our importance in this warfare, although we do have some in terms of informational warfare. But I think that there's something to that where we basically like warfare is meant to break up sort of like things like what we're doing, right? It's meant to get control over information flows and very much over logistical flows and like economic warfare and cutting countries off and sanctioning and everything like that. So the reason why I'm sort of going into this is that the war in Ukraine is really the first serious, I think, fifth generation war that we've seen. It's the first war where much of it is, of course, fought on the battlefield, but much of it is also not fought on the battlefield at all. Much of it is fought in terms of sanctions and in terms of, you know, like decoupling Russia from the SWIFT system and things like that. And it's fought in very much like, I mean, war has always involved propaganda, but propaganda is so important now, like in a way that it's like on an order of magnitude more than it has been in the past. And this is just how war is fought now. And what we're seeing is that the U.S. has basically been unable to force a much smaller country to knuckle under in the terms of war, like the battlefield that war is fought on now, has very much struggled to get Russia to bend the knee and to capitulate. So we're seeing something very interesting happen. Now, in terms of conventional war, of course, if the U.S. really wanted to, it could go in there and it could make Ukraine part of NATO. It would trigger the article that says, you know, if you fight one of us, then you're fighting all of us. And then they would go in there and with conventional war, they would clear them out pretty quickly. But the thing is, I don't think that the U.S. can afford to do that. And I think this is why they're trying to fight the war that they are. And it's very interesting because it has a lot of geopolitical implications of pushing Russia into the arms of the Chinese. And America, you know, certainly doesn't want to fight a war and then find that the Chinese invade Taiwan and then has to fight a two-front war and everything. And it's basically what I'm getting at is that America is in a much weaker position than it was even 20 years ago under the Bush years. And I think that the war hawks, the John McCain's of the current year are not in nearly as strong a position as they were back then, and that this is coming as a rude awakening. It's a very cold shower for these folks. And it's this, in addition to all the other stuff that's happened since Trump, is sending them into these paroxysms, these spasms, where they're making bad mistakes, and that I'm just sitting back and watching it like with my popcorn and just eating it up, you know, just loving it, because these are our enemies and they're getting their asses handed to them, and it's beautiful and I'm loving it.
You say that America couldn't afford a conventional war, like for America to go to war with Russia. Why could it not afford that?
Well, I think that America is suffering economically. I mean, it could afford it. It would be able to field the you know, artillery and the units that would need to get there, but it would come at such a cost, both militarily and in terms of just pure economics, that I don't think America is able to afford this. I think there's a reason why they're sitting back and just hoping that a war of attrition against Russia will eventually force Russia to capitulate. I think there's a reason why, you know, Nord Stream happened. There's like, it's that they're trying to do everything except actually put troops into the field, and that there's very good reason for this. It would be very expensive, and there's very little appetite for it. If you look at who's running the U.S. military these days, it's not a very impressive group of people compared to the past. Again, even compared to 20 years ago, if you just look at the photos of who is, you know, some of the military top brass, it's not the same caliber of people that they had before. I think America is a little bit worried that if they have to engage in an actual offensive against Russia, I mean, they of course would win, but the question is at what cost? And I think the cost is simply higher than they're willing to pay. So, you know, that's reason for hope, I think.
Yeah. It implies a power on the wane and a very corrupt power on the wane. I mean, I'm not just saying that for this, because it's America. It's, you know, America is a geopolitically destructive entity. So, there's reason for optimism there. And I do agree with you that America is not as wealthy as it was, is not as powerful as it was, but also that it's self-destructive. And this was something that came up earlier when we were talking about Afghanistan with, I think it was with Frody. And you've got all these transgender generals in the American army now. And I don't know if they're as numerous as they seem. It's possible that it's being really over-egged because they're the ones who get chosen for the photo shoots and whatever. But even that decision is indicative of decline. You know, imagine thinking, yeah, we'll put the transsexuals out, you know, front and center. We want people to see that our army, the army of the world superpower, is led by people with gender dysphoria. I mean, this is it's completely mental.
Yeah, it's just this runaway ideology that has to get more and more consistent and has been going on since the French Revolution. This is another thing I think that it's important to understand, not to get sidetracked, is that, you know, wokeness didn't just appear in like 1960 or something like that. It's been going on for hundreds of years. It was the earlier stages of cancer looked a lot less benign, or a lot more benign than the ones right now. But sort of to come back to the war thing, and the idea that the U.S. can't afford it. I mean, the world economy is so highly financialized that it just cannot be salvaged today. I think nobody wants to go to war because war would basically, like a real hot war between great powers would basically tip over the economy, the economies, not just of America, but which it certainly would, but also perhaps of China and Russia and Iran and many of these, you know, the biggest economies in the world. The world economy is so financialized that it's extremely fragile. And I mean, because these things like, you know, checks eventually do need to be cashed, metaphorically speaking. Like, we're always just not long away from a kind of global economic crisis, like that'll be much worse than 2008. And I think the reason why, and I don't know how much I can say here, also speaking very general terms, the reason why things went the way they did in 2020, and there was so much tyranny during this time, is basically to stave off an epic economic meltdown that you saw signs of in late 2019. I think the reason for turning world economies into command economies all of a sudden was, I mean, I would not say engineered, because I think it was, you know, happened as a result of a happy accident, but it was a crisis that couldn't be allowed to go to waste, that basically allowed these economies to right themselves, because basically you need to go into command economy mode when things look like they're getting pretty hairy in the bond market and whatnot. Like, this is what, I mean, command economies are what societies with their big boy pants on look like. So this, we needed to kind of do that because we were due for a severe economic downgrade. And this of course happened. But in doing that, you know, it would, if we didn't have an excuse to do that, if we just did it, it would kind of undermine the West's prevailing mythos, you know, that of freedom and all this nonsense. So, I mean, because we, and not just us, but like everybody globally. All the global economies are, have been based for a long time on buying and selling these like highly abstract debt instruments. I mean, that it turns out that that's not a great idea and that it can't go on indefinitely. And so I think that that's another reason why America wants to avoid a hot war, is because it would basically heat up, you know, markets like the bond market to a degree where it would actually trigger a cascade, and this would be disastrous. So this is one reason why I don't think, I mean, it America may see fit to actually do that, because it's, you know, it doesn't want to have that happen, but at the same time, it has its mythos as being the world hegemon to maintain. So it's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, all these things are not accidental. I mean, we're just getting to a point now where the complexity is so ubiquitous in the world that it's, we're living in a very fragile time, right? And I think this is part of the reason why, you know, the global American empire, shall we say, is not long for this world. Of course, we need to distinguish between the American empire and Americans. I think Americans as a whole are good people, and for the most part, you know, the vast majority of Americans do not want what their government is doing. But the American government, shall we say, is really running into a situation where it's fucked. it's damned if it does, and it's damned if it doesn't. And this is part of why, you know, things are getting so bad, is that the beast is kicking as it dies. And that's when it's dangerous. You know, it's very, very dangerous, as you well know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's kind of where we're getting to.
One other thought that occurs to me is about America not wanting a hot war. Do you think that they would be, and obviously this is obviously a layman's opinion that I'm asking for here, because I know you're not in a position to really know the answer to this, but do you think that America would be able to motivate enough young men to fight for it? Because the Russians have a concept of themselves and their country, their nation, as a place that's geographically rooted. It's an actual place. It's a country in the old-fashioned sense. I'm not convinced that an equal number of young American men have the same attachment to America or a sense of themselves as a people or even America as a place.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a better question for an American on the ground who has neighbors that are American that, you know, can get a better sense of this. But my sense of it is that that there's some while Americans are willing to fight for America as an ideal, that the ideal that's being fought for in Ukraine has nothing to do with that, and that they're not really behind it, nor should they be behind it. And they, you know, they've been talking about bringing back conscription for this very reason. So I don't think that there is the confidence there that the hegemon needs and has at its height. I think we're well past that. Like, you know, I tweeted out the other day that, you know, in 2016, the question on everyone's lips is like, at what point in the Roman Republic are we? And then, you know, 2020, it was more like, what part of the empire are we in, like, hundreds of years later? And now it's like, I saw somebody basically saying like, we're at the height of the empire. This is, you know, that same article that was saying that the deep state is consolidating. They were like, well, we're somewhere between, you know, Columella and Trajan or whatever, where it's like, we're at the height of the empire. I don't think so. But I think it's interesting how that question kind of moves around all the time. Where I think we're at is, I think we're very close to Odovaker. I think we're close to the end of the empire. I think we're a lot closer to that anyway than most people think. And that this is why we need to get hustled.
I would agree. I mean, I don't know how anyone could say, I can imagine this situation going on for decades and centuries yet. Yeah. Maybe decades, but not that many decades.
the era of American Caesarism, like to use the Spenglerian terms, right? Like Caesar is the Caesar figure is the one that comes in the winter. Of course, you know, Caesar coming in the beginning of the Roman Empire. The age of American Caesarism probably happened somewhere between Lincoln and FDR. Those are basically the two bookend Caesar figures in American history. We haven't really seen a Caesar figure after that. After that, it's been a degeneration of American executive figures. Just to look at the executive, you know, as a kind of bellwether, we've seen a severe degeneration. I mean, I'm no fan of FDR. People in our spheres are not, and like rightly so, not fans of FDR, but he was of a caliber that has not been seen since then. He is a very Odinic figure. He's a great man figure that comes to revolutionize and to set the society on a new foundation. We haven't seen anything like that for like 100 years or almost 100 years now. So I think we're well past the age of Caesarism. We're well into the empire. You know, I mean, we can only push these analogies so far. We get into kind of ridiculous territory if we're like, well, it was, you know, are we on this like, you know, Thursday or Tuesday in the empire? Yeah. But, you know, from a broad sweep, we can say that we're well into the imperial phase and that we're into the decline of the imperial phase. So, you know, this is like people just need to accept that, you know, and we accept that, but like people in the mainstream need to accept that because this is where we genuinely are. And this is why we've got so much hysteria is that we've got this, it's not just America, it's the West that has for a very long time had this, this fetishization of youthfulness that like, you know, we'll live forever, the forever young, civilization, where old age is something to be, it's not venerable at all. It's something to be laughed at, and we will never get there, right? Like the only culture worth having is a youthful culture. The only person worth listening to is a young person. We need to accept that that's not where we're at as a civilization, as the West. The West is very close to the end. So something new is going to come, and it's a matter of laying the foundations for that.
Okay. Well, let's get to the thing that one of the things that you wanted to talk about, which was reasons for hope, white pills, because I know that people in our sphere often ask about for that, and I'm not optimized for delivering white pills most of the time. So I will confess that, but you are. So why don't you take it away on that note?
Sure. I don't know. I think I am actually, as you say, optimized for this. I think that just in my constitution, I'm just oriented towards being optimistic for some reason. I don't know. But I think a lot of times people actually don't want white pills, which sounds weird to say. I think that sometimes, you know, folks, they don't want white pills because white pills mean that you actually have to do something. You know, it means that you can't just hunker down and play video games or whatever. I mean, I'm not shitting on video games here or anything like that, but you actually have to get out there and do something if it's possible to win. So that's a little bit scary, and I'm not trying to hack on anybody or whatever, but I do think that there are reasons for us to be optimistic. I mean, the first thing is that what we are doing right now in this thing, in whatever you want to call it, the nationalist right, let's just say, what is happening right now is world historical, what we're doing. And I don't think that we're tooting our own horn too much by saying that, because what's happened in the radical right since 2016, I am very confident that it will be studied 100 years from now. What we are actually defending now was until only very recently considered so brain dead obvious that no one ever thought to defend it before. No one ever thought to defend the idea that if you're born with a penis, you're a man or anything like this, right? So we have kind of been forced to formulate this body of theory that justifies the natural order of things, the like what is blatantly obvious, right? And this is, in some ways, actually kind of like the situation that the counter-Enlightenment thinkers faced after the French Revolution. Folks like, you know, Johann Georg Hamann and Maistre and Louis Bonald and people like that, much of what was taken as too obvious to even bother defending suddenly had to be defended. That's what we're doing. So I think people need to read these folks like Filmer and Maistre and Hamann and others, because we're basically continuing their intellectual project. And I think we are going to win, right? Like, but we need to accept that it's not going to be fixed in our lifetimes. And this is kind of one of the things that it's a white pill, but it's kind of tempered with, like, you know, we need to be realistic too, right? We're planting seeds for the future. Like there was this phrase said very often during the Russian Revolution. One, you know, communist revolutionary would say to the other, "I know you're tired, comrade." And what he meant was, it was usually a younger guy talking to an older guy, like an older revolutionary who would probably not live to see the revolution succeed. This comes back to me all the time. Like, I think about it very often, because most of us are probably not going to live to see liberalism come down. But that's no reason to be blackpilled. Like, we are planting seeds that are, like, they may not even sprout in our lifetimes. But somebody has to do it, right? Someone has to start building. We're here in this position today only because our forefathers were too cowardly, if we're being honest, to fix the problem themselves. You know, they didn't want to discuss politics. They didn't want to discuss religion at dinner or whatever, because it wasn't polite. But their enemies were happy to discuss politics and religion. In fact, their enemies took that very seriously. They took it deadly seriously. And eventually they destroyed everything that our fathers loved. And we're in this predicament because people tolerate shitty behavior every minute of every day. But when you speak up, when you yourself stand up and say no to whatever, I mean, we talk about the gender ideology, but you could talk about so many things. When you speak up against that stuff, it emboldens other people to speak up too. Like, we're planting these seeds, and they may not sprout for a very, very long time, but whatever actually needs to be done to fix the problem, whatever that problem is, I think the first thing we need to do is to accept that the problem's not going to be fixed in our lifetimes, but that it will be fixed. And I kind of like went into that a little bit with what I said before about how, you know, the empire is not winning, right? So here's just a little story. Like, you may have had a similar experience, because I think you and I are pretty close in age. I think you're maybe a couple years younger than me, but yeah, we're pretty close. I'm an Xennial, you know, on this cusp between Gen X and Millennial. So,
oh yes, yes.
And I remember, maybe you had the same thing when you were growing up, but I still remember the CFC ozone scare. Do you remember that? Did you have that back in the day?
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember that. Well, early 90s.
Yeah. So, like, for folks that are, you know, younger or whatever, at this time, we all thought that the Earth was going to end up as this irradiated wasteland. Like, the hole in the ozone layer was getting bigger. We thought that the Earth was going to just be Venus in, like, 50 years or something. And it wasn't just that. I mean, when I was in school, we were inundated with propaganda about environmental catastrophe, like, everywhere. I mean, I was convinced that by the time I was grown up, that there wouldn't even be a world left to live in. So I remember one day I came home. I don't remember how old I was. I probably wouldn't have been about 13 or 14 years old, something like that. You know, young man, young adolescent. And I just burst out crying uncontrollably. And my dad was like, "Well, what's wrong? What's wrong?" And I was just like, I just looked up at him and I'm like, "Dad, I don't want to die. I don't want the world to end. I want to have a future." And I remember what he told me. And I don't know why it stuck with me, but it did. And he told me, he said, "Son, just worry about what you can change." Right? And it sounds very prosaic. It doesn't sound very profound. But I really took it to heart. All these years later, too, I think this is the attitude that led to Imperium Press, right? Like, I'm not George Soros. I'm not Jeff Bezos. My influence is a lot smaller than these guys. But I can do something, right? I can, speaking of Jeff Bezos, I can infect Amazon with right-wing ideas. I can spread that through his platform. I can inspire tens of thousands of guys to reclaim their own intellectual heritage, right? And I could start a family. That's another thing I can do. I can teach my family to venerate their ancestors. I can make sure that my kids grow up without all the pause that surrounds us all. I can carve out a little space that's free of all that stuff. I can be example to other dads to do the same. So I would say the ultimate white pill is take this on board. Just worry about what you can change. If you take this advice, I mean, really take that advice. If you take it to heart, you'll probably never be black-pilled again. And I think this is a big part of why I'm sort of, constitutionally not black-pilled. I think there's a lot of reason for hope. It's going to get hard. Things are going to be very ugly for a while. But if you really think about your folk or if you're a communitarian and you're more worried about the community than yourself, that community extends into the future. And I think that future generations are going to be very glad that we did what we did. And I think that it's going to pay off. So, there you go.
Okay. Would another way to say this be to be aware of your own agency? Because I think that's something that certainly I've not been aware enough of my own agency in the past. And I think that it's quite typical, actually, nowadays. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, be realistic about it. But at the same time, you can start from somewhere. You can start from, for myself, for example. I started from just putting out, some books that were out of copyright and some books of friends, people that I knew that I was reading their blogs and I thought they had something to say. And it's grown into something where, this year, one of Time's 100 most influential people tweeted about one of our books. So you can go from A to B or A to C or A to D or whatever, but you just got to do it one step at a time kind of thing. I think a lot of times people look at the problem and they see that it's so massive and so overwhelming, this iceberg on the horizon, and they think, well, let's just give up. There's no point, right? But that's, I mean, the future belongs to people who don't give up, right? And we have a future as a people. There's, people think, the white race is going to die out because we're so, we have no ethnocentrism to us, and our cultural technology is so compromised. But there's 700 million of us on the planet. We're not going to die out, right? We're going to go through a bottleneck. There's going to be seriously hard times for us. But, hard times make for strong men, right? We're there. That's us. The strong men are coming. And it's our job to lay the foundations for them. It's our job to fashion ourselves into a tool that can be wielded, to fashion institutional technology and an institutional backbone that can be used by people who serve our interests, our ethnic interests, our ideological interests, our interests as a people. It's our job to build the foundation that's going to be able to be wielded to do that. And that's what we're doing. That's what Imperium Press is doing. But it's not just us. We're just a small part of a big puzzle. There's so many people who are blazing trails. I mean, you yourself, many, many years ago, you're one of the OGs, right? You were one of the first people to take your agency and to sit down in front of the camera in a dark room with a cigarette and tell it like it is. And that was very, very useful. That was important. That was important work, right? Which is why people, that's why you got doxxed. That's why, people were afraid of what we were doing, along with so many others back in the OG alt-right or whatever. This is important work that we're doing. I think we have to never lose sight of that. It's very important. It will be looked back on historically, and you have a chance today. I mean, if you ever wanted to be a hero, you could hardly live in a better time, I think, than today. This is the time when, like, the stuff of legends are made. We are living in the time that is going to be talked about in future folklore. I mean, our names might not survive, but the things we're doing will survive. So you can take solace in that, I think. There's no reason to be blackpilled at all.
Definitely. I mean, it is certainly true that in the darkest times, you know, there are things that can be done. I'm trying to think of a poetic way to say this to match what you're saying, but I don't think I can manage it at this time of night. But I guess the point is that there is something that each one of us can do, because the situation is so bad, because it is so dark. So I would urge people to realize that, and that will differ from one person to the next, what they can do and what they should do. But I think that the future has to happen one way or the other. And it'd be better if we were there. And it'd be better if our people were there. And it'd be better if our nations still existed in that future, one way or the other.
Well, we will be there. I mean, you think of that meme from 4chan from ages and ages ago, where it's like, you know, white people were some of the most tribal people on the planet. We were the people that fought each other to the death, you know, as like these little tribes or whatever, that would just fight and fight and fight until the bitter end. Like, you know, there's an anecdote in one of Caesar's chapters in the Gallic Wars, where he talks about, I'm trying to think who the tribe is right now. I can't think of who it is, but they, you know, basically they decide that they have to leave and go, you know, go a Viking. Like they're basically going to they're going to go move and like take over some new territory because they have to. And one of the first thing that they do when they leave their homes is that they burn them to the ground, right? And they burn them to the ground because then they'll have no reason to go back, right? Like that's big balls right there kind of thing. Those are the kind of people who, and I think actually, what was his name? Hernan Cortes did the same thing when he landed in the New World. First thing they did was they burned the ships so that they would have, so that it wouldn't be able to go back. This is the stuff out of which your forefathers were made. Our forefathers were some of the baddest, most hardcore motherfuckers that ever lived, and you have that in you. That is in your bloodline. So it's you're made of the same stuff. Don't ever think that it's not so. And if we are hereditarians, if we believe that blood actually, you know, that culture is incommunicable, and that different peoples are suited to different cultures because of their heredity and everything like that, then we must believe that we are essentially the same people as our forefathers. So hard times make for strong men. We are about to go through this bottleneck, and we're going to see what kind of stuff we're made of, and it's going to happen. So that's just a fait accompli. I think it's guaranteed at this point, and it's just a matter of sort of reviving some of what was forgotten perhaps in the past that would sort of allow us to sort of valorize that. Like there's a wonderful passage in the Iliad where Hector is about to go fight Achilles, and he says, "Now I go to die, but first I will do something that men will sing of in after time." And that's the attitude that we need to have, is that all in kind of attitude. So yeah, so I'm sorry, I don't know how I got onto the talking about this, but there you
go. That's okay. There have been a few super chats. Let me just go through them. Dave Martell wrote, "Buy Imperium Press books. They're the bee's knees. K Dads rise up." I'm not sure what that's a reference to, but.
Yeah, Dave is my broadcast partner. We didn't even get to haven't even got to talk about what's new with Imperium Press yet. So, Culture Dads is our new podcast. We basically the last year, we could talk about this a bit if you like. Last year has been a year of challenges for us and overcoming challenges. Speaking of what we were just talking about, Imperium Press has been under a lot of pressure this year, and we've overcome a lot of challenges. And one of the ways that we've done that is by starting a Gumroad, which basically enables people to, I mean, we have a new podcast that's exclusive to the Gumroad. We also have hardcover books exclusive to the Gumroad, but the podcast is Dave Martell and I talking about culture. And I think this is an interesting new podcast. There's so many great like podcasts and YouTube channels talking about politics and things like that. We touch on that a little bit, but ours is more of a focus on the things that matter to us in terms of culture, not necessarily like ancient culture, although again, we touch on that a little bit, but you know, we talk about things like the first episode we did was an extended review of The Godfather. You know, the next episode we did after that was a look at role-playing games, video games. We recently did an episode on post-punk. We recently did an episode on what it is to be a dad, fatherhood. We've also done episodes on language and how that, you know, plays into culture, how language reinforces culture and keeps cultures apart to some extent, which is a good thing. This is the kind of stuff that we talk about. We talk about cultural stuff, especially modern cultural stuff. We did a review on the movie The Thing recently. So I think this is kind of a fresh like take. This is it's not like we're the only ones doing that. I mean, Morgoth does wonderful movie reviews, and like there are others doing it as well. But we do it from a kind of folkish perspective. Dave and I are both pagans, so you know that seeps into some of what we talk about. This is what he's talking about when he says K-Dads, it's Culture Dads. This is our new podcast, and I'm very excited about it.
Okay, and Dave Martell will be appearing on Millennial later on. Can Imperium, this is from maybe next time, can Imperium Press put out a better, can they put out a better Herm's
Hermes Trismegistus. Yes. I'm very familiar with what you're talking about.
I knew I was messing it up. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah, quite possibly, actually. He's referring to the kind of alchemical and like hermetic texts from the Middle Ages. It's funny. I have a copy of the Hermetica on my desk here, actually, a very old copy, and he's right. It's the person who submitted that is right. It's not great. It certainly could use a better edition. Now, it is cool that like the edition I've got is got the Greek on one side and it's got the English translation on the other. But that would be an interesting one. We've got a Western canon series that we've been issuing, like the classics. I mean, we're starting with the kind of the core pillars of the Western canon. We've got the Iliad, we put out Beowulf, we put out a collection of folk tales. We've just recently released I think the best edition of the Poetic Edda that exists. And we will get there. We will definitely get to that stuff. The more people buy books and the more that we can kind of plow into, more we can reinvest into Imperium Press, the faster we're going to be able to put these things out. So you will eventually get yourself a copy of the Hermetica. I promise that.
Okay. Thank you. Hold on a second. Hammer, 3 credits. Thank you. Great White Lobster says Merry Christmas and Yuletide blessings. Thank you. And then Dave chips in again and says, we're going to build a bog and the propositionalists are going to pay for it. This was about when we were talking about civic nationalism at the start. Joey Duke says, Merry Christmas, Woes. I just bought your T-shirts. Great millennial so far. Thank you very much. He's referring to that there are official Millennial 2022 T-shirts available. It's on screen right now, actually, millennial.com/merch. I don't like the abbreviation merch, but I thought it was better to be brief. So there it is. All right. And Dave says, I recently started saying mucho to my Spanish friends. It means a lot to them. Darby says, the most pro-diversity and open borders people always live in a gated community and most never face the consequences of the policies they advocate. That's a terrible cliche at this point about liberals, that they always avoid the consequences of what they demand for society in general. It definitely has been true in the past, but I think at this stage the options for them to do that are actually wearing thin, because I mean a lot of liberals are poor. You know, they're not. I mean, you've got the writer for some stupid online magazine who is living in a bedsit in some crappy area of New York. It's not like, I don't think it's like the situation of the 90s or the 2000s where there was still a lot of money sloshing around and property wasn't at crippling prices yet, but it is now. And I think a lot of liberals are sort of suffering along with the rest of us, but that's almost like a test of their faith for them. So they believe in it all the harder.
Definitely. I mean, this is part of why they're getting so hysterical about it, is that, like, you know, in their lizard brain, you know, we are, as a species, we are wired to be very sensitive to status and differences in status, and people will live and die to gain status. Like, a lot of people would, like, genuinely rather be dead than be at the bottom of the status hierarchy. This is what that whole idea of bio-Leninism is about, is that, like, you know, status basically does everything, and this is what motivates people. And now being a liberal doesn't confer the status that it once did, because number one, I mean, it's been kind of it's saturated, right? Like, liberalism is just, it's what you're supposed to be. So, I mean, it doesn't actually really confer you the status that it once did. And yeah, as you say, the economic prosperity is just not what it once was. So, you know, those two factors taken together definitely indeed make it hard on these people.
Yeah, it's a change for them, and it's not a comfortable one. You know who says, happy millennial, everybody. Thank you for that super chat. Trad Dad says, thanks, millennial. Thanks, Imperium Press. I'm looking for the name of the title you republished that is all-encompassing highlight of many centuries. And he says, Merry Christmas. Do you know what he's referring to?
What was that again? Can you read it again?
I'm looking for the name of the title you republished that is an all-encompassing highlight of many centuries.
All-encompassing? I honestly don't know what that's referring to. Why don't we come back to that? I'll look at our catalog and see if anything jogs my memory. And we certainly have, probably the closest thing that we would have is the folk tales book, but yeah, I'll have to come back to that and see if something jogs my memory.
Okay. And then Dissident Echoes says, thank you for millennial woes. I've been watching since 2016. Well, thank you for watching. It's been going since 2015, but that was a sort of odd one, the first year. So 2016 was the first year with this sort of format. So, yeah, that you've been watching it since the start, effectively. So, yeah, it's nice that people stay and come back year after year. But anyway, I'm going to have to end this one because I'm exhausted. We've been going for an hour and a half, and that generally, I actually aim for about an hour, but it always goes beyond that too. So we've been going for an hour and a half, so I think that's, and we've talked about a lot of different things, but I'm shattered. I'm not yet in the correct sleeping pattern to be able to go till like 4 a.m. But all right, is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
Just visit imperiumpress.org. You know, we are doing lots of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's new this year that we've put out. There's a lot of stuff coming next year. keep an eye on us. I think next year is really going to be an important one for us. We're really going to move the dial on quite a few things, and in general, support focus economy, support the dissident economy, support guys like Millennial Woes, buy books from Antelope Hill and us and others, buy your coffee from Above Time Roasters and so on. The more you can of your Christmas shopping you can do in our sphere, the more it helps us, the more it strengthens us, and this can only be a good thing. So with that, thank you very much for having me on, Woes. Always enjoy it, and I hope everyone else enjoyed it too.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. I'll be back. I should have said at the start, one of the things I should have said at the very first stream is that there's going to be a Christmas card stream this year, which is a special one. I've never done it before, and it will be on Christmas Eve. And if people want to send a Christmas card that will be read out in that stream, they can do that at the address that is given on the on-screen graphic. And it will also appear, I'll use that outro, the address will appear there. And that's something new. If it works out this year, I'll do it every year. But I thought it'd be a nice sort of community thing for people to take part in. So that's something I meant to mention earlier. Okay, so I will be back again tomorrow for the second night. And there will be Greg Johnson, The Course of Empire, The Bizarre Archives, so that's Dave, and then another Dave, The Distributus. So that will be the second night of Millennial. This was the first night of Millennial. I hope that you all enjoyed it, and I hope that you join me tomorrow night. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.